Greetings and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate, coming your way from Press TV headquarters in Tehran. I'm your host, Behruz Ajafi. It's great to have you with us. The war in Syria seems to be on its last legs. Under a deal, militants in Idlib province, the last major bastion under the militants' control, have been given the opportunity to lay down their arms and evacuate the area. Meantime, at his UN General Assembly address, the Syrian foreign minister stressed that his government will fight, quote, occupying U.S., French, and Turkish forces. Walid Mualim also lashed out at a U.S. policy in Syria, accusing the coalition forces of committing mass killings and supporting terrorism. Now, why should the U.S. keep its forces in Syria when it is asked to leave and not to cause more death and destruction? What's Turkey seeking in Syria? We will discuss these and other similar questions in today's debate show. Let's begin with a report.
This is the tragic aftermath of an airstrike by the U.S.-led coalition that claims to be targeting battlegrounds to save civilians. But instead, homes are shattered and innocent people perish away. The coalition has been carrying out thousands of such bombardments in Syria and Iraq since 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh. But civilians have been the main victims of the attacks. While Washington claims the civilian casualties are less than 1,000, activists say the death toll is 10 times higher. A monitoring group called Air Wars says the U.S.-led coalition has killed as many as 9,600 civilians so far, a death toll from Western military action not seen since the Vietnam War. Some of the deadliest coalition attacks include
March 17, 2017, Mosul, Iraq. Nearly 300 killed. March 16, 2017, Aleppo, Syria. 46 people killed. July 12, 2018, Deir ez-Zor, Syria. 54 people killed. August 21st to 22nd, 2017, Raqqa, Syria. 100 civilians killed.
Rights groups have accused the U.S. and its allies of potential war crimes because of their indiscriminate bombings. Washington has acknowledged that its attacks in Raqqa have led to the death of 77 civilians between June and October 2017. However, Amnesty International says the admission is just the tip of the iceberg.
The coalition's admission that it killed 77 civilians in Raqqa is just the tip of the iceberg. The coalition needs to release meaningful and verifiable information about how targets in Raqqa were selected and how strikes were carried out.
Air Wars found the coalition was responsible for some 1,400 of the estimated 2,000 civilian casualties during the four-month offensive there. The United Nations war crimes investigators have raised the alarm over the situation.
We note in particular that the intensification of air strikes, which have paved the ground for an SDF advance in Raqqa, has resulted not only in staggering loss of civilian life, but has also led to 160,000 civilians fleeing their homes.
Despite protests from the Syrian government and pressure from rights groups, the U.S.-led coalition still pushes ahead with its operations in Syria without accountability. Some now believe that it's time for the international community to take effective measures in order to save innocent lives.
Okay, now let me introduce the guests who are joining us in this debate. We'll have Jihad Morakata, who is a political analyst, joining us from Beirut. And then we'll also have Adam Gary, editor and director with Eurasia Future, who is joining us from London. Thank you both, gentlemen. Let me start with Jihad. Jihad, the Syrian foreign minister, Mualim, says that the presence of U.S., French, and Turkish troops in Syria is not legitimate, and they will be dealt with accordingly. Now, Syria has not invited those forces to help it, and they're not wanted there. So what is the objective behind the presence of these forces in Syria?
First of all, let me say that the reasoning of Mr. Mualim, the foreign minister, Mr. Mualim, is absolutely correct. The Syrian government never invited these specific troops in. They invited the Russians and the Iranians, but and Hezbollah, but not the Turks and the Americans. Now, this being said, it is really up to the Syrian government to decide how their country is going to be run. If it's going to be run by Russia, it's one thing. If it's going to be run by Iraq and, by the US and Turkey, it's something else. In other words, Turkey has come into Syria because Syria could not control its border. The US has come into Syria to help the Kurds and protect the border between Iraq and Syria because Syria was not able to do its job. So they don't need to be invited. It is Syria which is not being capable of doing its own job of protecting its own borders.
Okay, Adam Gary, the Jihad believes that the U.S. forces are there to offer some help to the Damascus government. Is that really so, you think?
I'm sorry, that's not what I said.
The U.S. there to help the Damascus government? Well, that contradicts everything that everyone has said in the last 7 years.
That's,
no, what the U.S. is there to do east of the Euphrates in particular is two things. One, they're there for the oil, because that's where the majority of Syria's oil is located. Two, they're there to aid the PKK-YPG terror group in order to gain leverage against its putative NATO ally Turkey, which is really not much of an ally anymore. How can a country like the US, which backs a terror group that's mission is to overthrow the Turkish state, how can that be called an alliance? I certainly don't know. So they're certainly putting pressure on Turkey through that, very disconcertingly. And they're thirdly trying to destroy the territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic by backing a separatist PKK-YPG force east of the Euphrates. Initially, of course, the United States wanted to overthrow the government of Syria. That didn't happen because primarily of the intervention by the Russian aerospace forces and other military advisors on the ground. And so because of that, the primary objective of the U.S. right now is to take the oil in the east, provoke Turkey as much as possible, and to essentially balkanize Syria. Those are the three goals.
Okay, Jihad, maybe I misheard you. What was your stance again on the U.S. presence in Syria?
I never said that. I said the U.S. and Turkey are there because Syria is incapable of protecting its borders, not there to help Syria. So I'm sorry, you said it.
I see.
They are here to help Syria, not here to help Syria.
You say they are
second,
there because Syria is incapable.
The argument about...
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, not incapable of holding its own borders.
All right.
Not to help it at all, because Syria has invited terrorists in, and they are here to stop the terrorists that Syria has invited. On the other hand, the oil argument does not stand for a very simple reason. I don't think the U.S., who has enormous reserves of oil today, which is the first producer in the world together with Saudi Arabia, need the Syrian oil. So the oil argument does not stand. As for the argument about the PKK and the YPG, I agree with you, they are supporting the YPG and the PKK, but in order to keep the area under their control. Now, if your argument is they are here to help the PKK and YPG, why is Turkey in?
Okay, Adam Gary, you want to comment on that? And also at the same time, Jihad, Syria never invited them, whether capable or incapable. How do you feel? How would you feel if another
they don't
country,
need to invite them.
A foreign country comes to you and can they force you to say, let us fight terrorism for you? Okay,
yes,
let's go. Okay, let's have Adam comment on that.
Can I just answer very quickly this
go
point?
Go ahead.
And just very quickly.
Go ahead.
Very quickly. Syria is not a country anymore. The minute Syria's civil war started and Syria invited foreign forces in and terrorists were blowing things all over the place and the Syrian regime was blowing its own citizens all over the place, Syria stopped being a country. It's not respected by the international community, except for a few countries. Yes, if you take the Security Council, sir, the permanent members of the Security Council do not respect Syria, except for Russia and China. You take the majority of Security Council that don't respect Syria. Nobody talks to Syria, and nobody is interested in Syria anymore. Syria is not a country. It's not like it's an independent country that's been invaded.
Let's go to Adam, but you know that Jihad should also know that Syrian Foreign Minister was speaking at the UN General Assembly as the representative of the Syrian Arab Republic. Why do you think, Adam, that jihad does not consider this Syria as a country and that nobody is interested in? So why is U.S. there? Adam?
Well, it was Otto von Bismarck who said that Italy is little more than a geographical expression. And unless one thinks that Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot of 1916 fame somehow knew more about the Arab world than the Arabs themselves, one could say that every Arab country as currently drawn in terms of its borders is not an actual country.
Today,
and in that sense, I would agree, because I believe that salvation will only come to the Arab world if the entire Arab world unites and becomes a superpower. It would be one of the largest countries in the world if it were to unite. And I don't know who keeps shouting in my ear, but I do wish they'd shut up. But if the Arabs did unite, they would be a force to be reckoned with rather than a force to be exploited, invaded, and degraded by everyone from the Zionists to the American imperialists to the neo-European imperialists and everywhere in between. So if that's what we're talking about by not being a country, I suppose I'd agree. But beyond that, I really don't understand the point of the premise.
Okay, jihad. Jihad,
well,
my question
you don't
for
understand
you.
Because you did not listen. I am talking, excuse me, I'm talking about Syria today. I'm not talking about Syria since Sykes Picot.
Okay, all right, jihad.
So
you commented and
English,
he commented on yours. Okay, no problem. We're not fighting over it. We're just discussing things. Now, jihad, the Damascus government insists that it will keep fighting till it clears the entire country. And you know, it's only Idlib it remains with terrorists operating there, and they're leaving under that deal. Now, how do you predict things will go in Syria? And who do you think is the real supporter of Syria?
Well, if anybody, does anybody believe that Syria seriously is fighting? Syria and the Syrian regime cannot do any fighting. Without the Russian and the Iranians and Hezbollah, Syria cannot do any fighting. The Syrian regime, it's a joke. The military is a joke. It is the Syria, it is the Russian military who are doing the fight in the air with, and they are directing the fight, and the other militias which are on the ground are helping out. So when Walid Muallim, the foreign minister, says anything about what he wants to do, it's totally irrelevant. Nobody believes him anymore. Second, where are things are going to go? Things are going to go the following way. Idlib now is under the control of Turkey with the agreement of Russia. In fact, Syria pulled out troops out of the Idlib area to go and fight in Suwaida, and they even took with them some Hezbollah fighters to fight in the south in Suwaida, because the situation in the south is not yet completely under control. And this has been going on since August, the war in Suwaida. So they left Idlib to the Turks. They cannot do anything with the Kurds in the north because the Americans are there. So all the north of the country is not in their possession, and there is nothing they can do, whatever Mr. Muallim says, about controlling it. And for your information, the south of Syria, the reason the Syrian regime has been able to come into the south, it is because Bibi Netanyahu requested President Putin to get the Syrian regime to take control of the area to protect the borders of Israel in the Golan Heights.
Okay, we'll come to that one later on the show.
Because Israelis could not trust.
We'll come to that. We'll discuss it in a few minutes' time. Okay, let me go to London and Adam Gary. Adam, regarding Idlib, I also want your comment on that, because Idlib is being run by militants. Some of them Turkey may be used to support. Now, whatever, under that deal, now they are given the chance to lay down their arms and leave, and some of them are already leaving. Now, how do you predict the situation to unfold?
Well, in order to understand what's going on in Idlib, one has to understand how the victorious powers in the Second World War divided various areas which they rid of an enemy amongst themselves. These are called zones of occupation, sometimes known as zones of influence. The deal between Russia and Turkey on Idlib is essentially one of those types of deals, whereby the majority of Idlib province, and the north of the province in particular, is an area of Turkish influence. It's a zone of Turkish occupation. The southern border of the Idlib governorate is under the control of the Syrian government and its traditional allies, and there's essentially an area in between, a kind of invisible rampart that's being called a demilitarized zone, much like what the 38th parallel in the Korean Peninsula is referred to, and this is sort of an area where none shall cross. Jihad is correct in saying that the Syrian and allied Hezbollah troops have indeed withdrawn from the area as part of this deal. I don't see any battles as such between any of the state armies flaring up in Idlib. Of course, you've got various militant groups that have been fighting with each other for well over a year now. That may well continue unless some of the responsible international parties are able to effectively de-escalate that. But for now, it's essentially a frozen governorate, one split between zones of influence. And I don't see those proverbial and indeed in some cases literal lines in the sand changing anytime soon.
Okay, to Beirut now. Jihad, you were talking about Golan Heights and the southern part of Syria. Keep commenting on that now at this point.
No, I was just saying that part of the deal between Bibi Netanyahu and Mr. Putin was that the Israelis wanted the Syrian government to be directly responsible for the 1973 demilitarized zone, which ended the war between Syria and Israel at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, did not end the war, just ceasefire line. And so they wanted somebody responsible for that. And they said the Syrian government will be responsible for that, along with Russian police. So this will keep the border free and clear of any terrorists trying to attack Israel. This was the point of view of the Israelis. On this basis, the Jordanian agreed, and they had a tripartite agreement between Russia, Jordan, and Israel to allow the Syrian government to move in and clean the area of terrorists there. And this is what happened, and this is why the Syrian army was allowed to go in, not because there was any kind of conquest on the part of the Syrians.
Okay, to London. Adam? Foreign Minister Mualim has also accused Israel of backing terrorist groups in southern Syria by, quote, direct military intervention and repeated attacks. Now, Syria is determined to liberate the Israel-occupied Golan Heights. It's asking the international community, for example, to compel Israel to abide by UN Security Council resolutions, including the one regarding Golan Heights. Now, will Tel Aviv take heed of UN calls? And what do you think is the way to restore Syrian sovereignty over the Golan Heights?
Well, indeed, it's wise to remember that Israel has been at war against Syria since at least 1967, and the war has never ended. The occupation has never ended. Amongst the arsenals of the various Takfiri terrorist groups throughout Syria, Israeli radio equipment, Israeli weapons, Israeli medicines have been found by the dozen, by the score. Israel has been primarily responsible for goading the Western powers into yet another illegal war in yet another Arab country, and this responsibility that Tel Aviv bears can never be expunged, however much many might try to whitewash it. As to the agreement on the de facto border between Syria and Israel, the purple line as defined in 1967 and as enshrined in the 74 ceasefire, the agreement between Russia and Israel wasn't so much of allowing Syria Syria to go back into its own territory, as we've just heard. But the agreement had everything to do with the presence or lack thereof of Iranian and pro-Iranian troops. The way that the deal worked out is that Israel agreed not to negatively interfere in Syria, the Syrian Arab Army's reconquest of its own territories in that region, so long as Russia would ensure that Hezbollah and Iranian agents weren't directly involved in those operations. That deal is done, all sides have been satisfied, and as for the occupied Golan Heights, I honestly don't see that status quo changing for a long time. The impetus isn't there. The Syrians aren't able to liberate the territory by themselves, and no other military power capable of doing so is going to do it, not least Russia, which is a partner of Iran and Israel and Syria and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Egypt. So Russia needs to maintain its sense of balance. It's certainly not going to skew that balance one way or the other in that respect, nor will any other superpower for that matter.
Okay, let's go to Beirut. Jihad, speaking of Iran, Iran is saying that it will keep its advisory mission in Syria. And Tehran says that advisors are there upon request by Damascus, and Damascus government has time and again approved that this is being done on its invitation. Let's have your comment on this.
I have no comment. There is a government in Damascus. This government is in Damascus is dealing with whoever he wants to deal with, as long as he can, as long as it can deal with it. In other words, there are areas where you have Americans, as you started by saying, but they cannot deal with the Americans and the Kurds in the north of the country. They cannot deal with the Turks. They can only deal with the Israelis via Russia. They can deal with Iran, and they can invite Iran in, whether it's advisors or militaries or
militias. Maybe they have good reason for that, huh? Iranians helped Iraqis defeat Daesh, for instance. Isn't that reason enough?
Well, I don't think the Syrian government did anything against Daesh.
No, Iranians did so, and this is a good reason for Syria to be interested, for an Iranian presence there.
The Syrians were interested in defeating the opposition, and the Iranians helped them to defeat that opposition. Okay. Not to defeat Daesh,
okay.
To defeat those people opposed to the regime.
All right, we're running out of time. Adam, let's have your final comments. 30 seconds, please.
If there is any lesson to be learned from this disastrous war in Syria, and I'm sure that most leaders are too naive to learn it, it's that government should never back anyone but other governments. And if they have disputes, they should resolve these through dialogue. And if need be, no relations is better than relations with terror groups of any kind. A terror group anywhere is a threat to people everywhere. It doesn't matter if it's Daesh, if it's Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, if it's PKK, if it's MEK, if it's any of these terror groups, any terror group is dangerous. Deal with governments, do not deal with ragtag gangsters masquerading as terrorist groups calling themselves freedom fighters. It's rubbish. Will it happen? No, we don't live in an ideal world. We never will.
All right. And that note, we come to the end of tonight's edition of The Debate. Let me thank our guests, Jihad Murakkada, political analyst joining us from Beirut, and also Adam Gary, editor and director with Eurasia Future, joining us from London. Thank you both, gentlemen, and thank you for watching this edition of The Debate on Press. We'll see you next time.